asking for money sucks. The way that debt works in our country right now is messed up. It's really tough to figure out lending practices. Where can you get money if you need it? Whether you're buying a house, you talk about credit card debt, you talk about personal loans, payday loans. Debt is really messed up in our country if we're being honest with ourselves. And that's why I'm really excited to sit down with Sean Huntofta, originally from Scotland, but lives in the US now, who is building a company called Solve Finance that has a new model that makes lending and borrowing money easy. Essentially, Solve Finance is the one place you go to be able to figure out what's the best options for you. And the way they've done this is by not taking commissions and fees from the lenders themselves, right? If you just Google, you know, get a mortgage or anything like that, you're gonna end up getting all of the same companies recommended, the ones that provide the best fees to people that recommend their products. And so Solve Finance is absolutely flipping this on its head and has a really interesting model. And so Sean and I go really deep into lending in general and borrowing money and all the things that are messed up with it. We also talk about how do you build a fintech company. Sean's got a ton of experience and is really valuable story for other entrepreneurs that are interested in building the space. So I hope you enjoy this lending fintech focused episode of the Silicon Alley podcast featuring the Sean Huntofta. Are you interested in growing and scaling your business? Welcome to the Silicon Alley podcast, where you'll hear from entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and top performers on what it truly takes to grow and scale a business. You'll walk away with actionable insights you can apply in your own business and life. Now to William Glass, the CEO and co-founder of Ostrich, and your host of the Silicon Alley podcast. Sean, welcome to the Silicon Alley podcast. Super excited to have you on today.
Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, I have as well. And we had a conversation now, it's got to have been, a couple months ago that was really interesting just about personal finance and a lot of things that unfortunately are broken in society. And then we had the pleasure of actually getting to meet each other last week at the New York FinTech Week, which was really awesome.
Yeah, it's always nice in these, pandemic and post-pandemic times to get to meet people in real life.
It is. It's a treat, you know. It's a treat to actually get to not just talk over Zoom or over a phone call. So, but I'm really excited to dive in. And you've got a really interesting background, having worked at some really notable financial institutions, have worked at the Fed, have worked for some really impressive startups. So I'm really just curious, like, what got you really interested in finance in general? Because, you know, a lot of people have no interest whatsoever in the topic.
Yeah, that's a great question. Although, I'm sure all your questions are going to be great today. So I shouldn't single one out. But yeah, I started off life as a computer scientist. So, you know, think of 16 or 17 year old Sean. I wanted to do something new. And, you know, that was back in the 90s for me. And that was doing computer science. I'd never programmed anything before university. And I came out of university and was applying computer science in surgical robot settings and helping people perform surgery better. And finance was just sort of another area to apply the same pattern recognition, or, you know, ML, as we'd call it these days, into, you know, it's just another interesting set of problems. And I started off, my first ever paid job really was on a fixed income trading desk and the early days of high frequency trading back in, 01 in New York City. And yeah, it was just a slippery slope from there. I started off with interest rates and then pretty quickly got into mortgages and consumer finance. And then the last 20 years of my life have all been in consumer finance. So I started off as an investor or on the investing side. I was a portfolio manager at a hedge fund. I was buying bonds, pools of distressed loans, bits of failed banks in the great financial crisis. I saw households making costly mistakes. And that's really when I transitioned from being on the passive trading and investing side of finance, like the capital markets end, to the primary market end. And how can we help households navigate the minefield of household finance that we've set for them, you know, especially in the US. And yeah, then got into hard research, PhD, adjunct professor, NYU Stern, researcher at the New York Fed, and then came back to the real world, originating credit at Better Mortgage, and then, you know, solving problems more directly at Sol Finance.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's, yeah, you've done a lot like in the finance space. What was it that led you into the consumer side, right? Like, I mean, it's interesting, all of the, you know, the alternative assets and bonds and all the things that you were doing on the commercial side, the capital market side. But what is it about consumer finance that has really captured you over the last, as you said, 15, 20 years?
Yeah, just it really ties together to that same idea of, you know, why was I doing computer vision and pattern recognition and surgery? It was to help people do a better job of something that technology can easily help with. And I saw in my investment portfolios, households clearly not acting, you know, like perfectly informed robot borrowers and making costly mistakes that they might not even know are mistakes. But, you know, from the trader perspective, someone who has all the world of data and all the models and knows how something's likely to play out is, you know, clearly something that you could help them with. And so, you know, I started off with the question of, okay, well, you know, what's explaining these behaviors? Is it lack of information or behavioral biases? And, you know, ended up, you know, essentially doing a lot of behavioral economics in household finance in the PhD and subsequent research, and basically pointing out to, you know, older, more established researchers how, you know, different of household behavior were wrong or incorrect compared to reality. And then it's, yeah, since then it's been, well, how can technology, you know, help people in the real world? And there's just a lot of you know, hate to overuse the word mistake, but there's lots of things that people could be doing better and technology could easily help them with. And, you know, my take and the founding thesis behind Sol Finance is the main reason why technology hasn't been helping them do a better job with their debts is really incentives. And that it's, you know, that most business models have been web 1.0 and advertising driven. And you really just need the right incentives of actually acting as a fiduciary for households, you know, acting, you know, as with these long run outcomes, you know, what's best in the long run for a business, rather than how do I make the most money this month? Because if you're focused on what's making the most money this month, you'll end up, you know, selling people for referral fees and getting kickbacks. And as soon as you're in the game of generating revenue, you know, purely from kickbacks and referral fees and passing your user traffic off to a subset of lenders, then you're no longer in the game, you know, like much more fun technology problem of how can we do the best job possible automating finance for someone?
I love that. And there's a couple of areas that I want to dive in on, but I just want to take a quick step back. And you mentioned that you're looking at these models and people aren't acting in the most, I'll say rational way. I'm not sure that you use that term, but you know, this idea, right, in economics that everyone acts, you know, perfectly rationally. And can you talk a little bit about that and why that is an important concept to understand when it comes to consumers and consumer finance?
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, and it's sort of a great framework just to be clear about. So there's sort of two main pieces to it for, you know, how has US regulatory policy approached households, and, you know, what model is in the head of, you know, someone chairing the Fed or an economist at the CFPB maybe, or, you know, what's being drilled into them from their economics training. And there's two main components. One is you're fully informed, and the other bit is you're perfectly rational. So rational sort of describes the preferences and how you'd set up and solve a problem. It's things like, you know, you're cognitively unlimited. You know, there is no end to your processing capacity in taking in the information and what to do with it, and that you're going to handle that information perfectly and instantaneously and update your behavior accordingly. And then the other part of it is being perfectly informed. So it's the idea as if household sees what's going on with all the households in the economy and has the benefit of that researcher or that lender or whoever's looking to, you know, study household behavior. They have the benefit of being fully informed and knowing what the odds of, you know, the various horse races that they're betting on are. And so, you know, one is like, you know the perfect history of a racehorse. That's like the fully informed bit. And then the other bit is you're going to bet on it perfectly rationally. So you aren't going to, for instance, prefer long shots and really high payoffs that have a really low probability of paying out to, you know, the favorites. And, you know, and you aren't going to take bets that are, you know, negative NPV. And both, like, clearly just from describing it, you know, if I described it to my mom, like, hey, mom, this is what our regulatory policy is based on. You know, like, my mom would clearly find holes to pick in both of those. And then the question is, like, well, how far does reality deviate from that? And how does it deviate from it in meaningful ways? And, you know, the obvious position that I take is, you know, compared to interest rate markets where I started off, it's not that far a deviation, right? You have lots of really sophisticated investors and counterparties on all sides making bets on these rates. You know, they have teams, you know, that I or and others have built up, and technology playing on all sides of the equation. But in household finance, you know, and especially the borrowing side of the balance sheet versus the stock market, on the borrowing side, what you have is this very lopsided informational space where lenders or, you know, intermediaries like the Nerd Wallets or Smart Assets, various, you know, any insert name of fintech lender or affiliate marketing platform here, they have the teams and the data. And then an ordinary human, an ordinary US household on the other side, A, does not have the data. And then B, yeah, you know, is just an ordinary human. So they might, you know, they might not have a week to set up a model, or they might not be able to set the right model up, you know, for prepayment or default or likelihood of getting a job again, you know, in 6 months versus a year. So they'll do things like overpay on debts that are in default. They'll pay too long. They'll wait too long to file bankruptcy. They'll do things like cut up their credit cards when, you know, a credit card is a free option to borrow if you don't have a balance on it. But they know their own weaknesses, or they know their spouse's weakness of spending on that credit card. So, you know, they'll sort of self-commit to austerity, or they'll use less credit when times are bad rather than, you know, smooth out consumption. Or they'll be slow to react to interest rates and they won't refinance efficiently. So, you know, that sort of, you know, nicknamed woodheads, you know, rates change and then it's only when there's been enough press or news about it that people might see that and do something about it. You know, they're busy and juggling lots of jobs. So yeah, there's just like a whole wealth of different and varied ways in which people essentially lose money in borrowing markets, and they might not even know that they're losing money. I mean, another one is just shopping for credit. So prices are complicated. The perfect robot borrower would be instantly able to assess mortgage prices, but in reality, you know, most people can't. MBAs can't, even after I teach a class to them on how to do it. And so, yeah, that's sort of like a more like boundedly rational model of human behavior. And so what does that end up doing? It ends up making, you know, lenders earn higher margins than what they would do otherwise, and households are overpaying compared to what they would do otherwise.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense tonight. Yeah, I appreciate you explaining that, because essentially what you just described is just human nature and behavior, right? It's of course you never have all of the information and you're never fully informed. And then even if you do, you know, who's got the capacity to go through every single scenario like a computer to figure all that stuff out in your head, right? Let's be very realistic. Even the most sophisticated, to your point, folks, right? Like you said, you teach in MBAs. Who, you know, understand how to do complex models, aren't able to do this themselves when it comes to lending and mortgage rates. So, clearly there's a problem here, right?
Yeah. And, you know, just on that spectrum. So MBAs, have gotten lots of classes, right? You're already a graduate degree student. You'll end up having higher income. You might be making mistakes, but they're sort of smaller in size, less frequent in nature. You're acting, you know, more like the Wall Street trading desk of interest rates. But you know, the inequity is that it's ordinary households, you know, median incomes or lower, that are more likely to make mistakes, more sizable mistakes, that are, you know, more meaningful. You've got less of a safety cushion to start off with. So, you know, like this, treating people like the perfect, you know, really well-advised, wealthy MBA, you know, ends up benefiting, you know, relatively, it ends up disadvantaging ordinary households, relatively speaking, because we're giving them problems that they aren't trained or advised to handle, and is probably like one of the many factors driving a persistent wealth gap by, you know, income and education, and then of course, you know, the backgrounds that correlate with that.
Absolutely, yeah. There's, to your point, yeah, there's people that that are in a much tougher position when you start to look at that, yeah, middle to lower income group, that that it, you know, the smaller mistakes obviously add up as well and just have a much bigger impact. What are the implications of us, you know, and we can talk a little bit about this, but I'm just like, what are the implications of us not fixing this kind of system, this incentive structure, right? Because you mentioned, the other thing you mentioned was that a lot of incentives aren't aligned in this space, and that's a big problem. Can you talk a little bit about that, Sean, and why you think that's so important to get incentives aligned properly?
Yeah. I mean, one of the observations I'd make is that a lot of innovation on the credit side is around lending technologies or new lending platforms, and less to advisory or automation, you know, on the borrower side. And so, right, like back to that description of this being a, you know, like an informational disadvantage, right? There's a seesaw with more weight on one side. You know, if all the dollars and bright minds are going to one side and not the other, that's just going to be an unfair race. It's going to be an unfair competition. And you can't rely on corporations that are, you know, driven by, you know, not only the corporation, but the capital provider and the source of capital might be driven by shorter term perspectives and might not have the longer term view of like, okay, but we can build a much bigger business, you know, by being the trusted advisor for borrowers, you know, 10 years from now. Yeah, you're just going to end up with more people looking to maximize profits rather than minimize profits for lending platforms. It takes a pretty, you know, it takes a pretty good set of guardrails and constraints for a lending platform to, you know, like at the end of the day, they're in it for revenue and for unit economics. You know, even if you do take the run view, you still, yeah, my thought is you need someone fighting on the side of households, or at least a few people, and on the financial problem that means most to them, where them is, you know, the first 90% of US households. And that financial problem is credit and borrowing. And there's various stages, you know, and there's, you know, luckily there is startup activity, you know, across the spectrum. There's, you know, how to deal with debts that are in default or delinquent. But again, you know, probably I'd say the biggest startups on, you know, even on that side are more working on the side of lenders. And how, you know, to handle debt collection from the lender side rather than how to ruthlessly negotiate as hard as possible on the household side. Yeah, so my argument would be it's important to get the, you know, people that are incentive aligned with the household and to have innovation on that side in order to level the playing field. And otherwise, it's an unlevel playing field.
I totally agree, Sean, and I think that's one of the things that kind of drew us to connect in the first place, right? Is what you're doing, and I would love for you to talk a little bit about what you're doing at Saul Finance, and you know, kind of what we're our approach that we're taking on, because they're very similar, right? It's really focused on the consumer over the, you know, lender or the transactions that may or may not be in the best interest of the individual. So can you talk to me a little bit about like how you have like Saul Finance and then how you guys have modeled your business?
Yeah, you know, so it's early days for us. We're only a year in, so there'll be, you know, doubtless more, you know, experimentation and iteration on how to do things. But like you touched on, like things that I think you have to avoid are, you know, restricting the set of options for the end user, you know, especially if you're restricting them based on how much someone is paying you to steer traffic to an option, whether that's a house and a realtor, or whether it's a mortgage or a personal loan, or, the provider of wealth advisory services or anything. Pricing models, I think, that help avoid that. You know, at the simplest level, you can just not take referral fees. That's what we're doing currently. A subscription-based model is, you know, one that's paid by the consumer or by a sponsor on behalf of that consumer or the household. Seems to be a pretty safe way to do it. I could also imagine something that's success fee based or success oriented. That gets to be more complicated. And in my user research, you know, humans tend not to like complicated pricing structures. So, you know, the MBA might go like, oh yeah, that's perfectly incentive aligned model where, you know, you get paid X basis points when you've saved me, you know, Y percentage points. That might appeal to the MBAs and, you know, super sophisticates more than the ordinary people. So yeah, I think there's a multitude of ways of going about it. And just it's, you know, like first principles, what do you need to do? You need to not let money from that's coming, like not from not the end user, steer what you're presenting to them. And yeah, like if you start a business where the number one goal is financial outcomes rather than advertising revenue, then I think, yeah, just naturally you're going to be in a much better spot than, I'm not suggesting that any of these large, bastions of online borrowing advice that I saw out there. So I ran D2C marketing at Better Mortgage, which is when I got this, you know, mm-hmm. deep insight of the conflicted incentives. I saw NerdWallet sending the majority of its click leads to Quicken costs over $5,000 more for a typical mortgage at the closing table for the same person, same home, same everything than Better did. And it's not like the founders of NerdWallet 10 whatever years ago, you know, like designed that. What they set up was a mousetrap, and, you know, the immediately available revenue was referral fees. But then when you put lots of bright people in the room, you know, back to that traders and MBA minds together, you know, without the appropriate guardrails or, you know, without the appropriate constraints, 10 years later, what you've ended up doing is a really good job of maximizing referral fee revenue, which precisely ends up with you sending the majority of your volume to Quicken rather than the low cost new entrant. So that's why incentives matter. And you just have to think of like what's going to happen, you know, years from now when we ruthlessly maximize this objective function and give it time to develop. Because it could be that you can do a good job day one, but, you know, if you set up the incentives for the firm to do something else, then I think it just naturally, by evolution, it's going to grow to doing something else.
Absolutely. No, yeah, that makes sense, Sean. And something that has always frustrated me, right, is when you go look at, search best investing app or mortgage or all that, you end up seeing the same providers, even if you click on the top, you know, 2-3 pages worth of links.
Yeah.
Because it's just whoever ranks for Google. And then to your point, yeah, the companies that are on there pay a higher referral fee. And it's not that those companies or people creating those websites or lists are evil, to your point, or anything like that, that they're trying to dupe people. It's just that's how they make money. So they're optimizing for that. And we can't necessarily fault the system, but if you don't know that, right, then you probably assume that you are getting the list of the top whatever, you know, mortgage lenders, to the top mortgage lenders who have great referral fees, so they're on every list that ranks on Google, which is different.
Yeah, and that's a great thing to keep up, you know, like, or to bring up, you know, part of this information architecture that households have is online search, you know, and that's the number one source that people go to after friends and family for any financial question. And so, you know, in a way, Google started off with this unbiased search engine and the best possible answers coming first, you know, rather than just sort of random or, you know, like old Yahoo. You know, when I was a computer science student, you know, and part of the original Google paper was that these other search engines and ways of accessing information are bad precisely because they're driven by ad revenue, you know, like the 99 or 2000 white paper. And but, you know, what's happened over time, you know, even Google, not, you know, not intending to be evil, has over time is like essentially cashed out or is cashing out on its trusted position and monetized that trust that they built up initially to basically like misserve results and have the top results, you know, go partially to whoever bids the most and not necessarily whatever the best answer is.
Exactly. Right. So yeah, there's just, there's, yeah, unfortunately it's not as easy as a Google search, right, to find the right information, like it should be. So this makes a lot of sense, John, right? Like wanting to really create incentives that are aligned and some of the different ways that you've talked about that, you know, the referral fees, obviously, that we've gone into thinking about doing no referral fees, having a subscription model, success-based fees, which I think is really interesting. And to your point, though, how do you create a success-based fee that isn't overly complex is a whole other challenge in and of itself. So what exactly does Solve Finance do? Can you like talk me through like what is that experience like? Who's your target customer? Like what is it that you solve for your customers?
Yeah. So, you know, for the next couple of years, our target customer is a business who's going to sponsor, who's interested in better borrowing by its users and de-stressing their borrowing lives. So, you know, whether that's an early upstart financial planning app, you know, that currently is just looking at transaction data, or whether it's a neobank that doesn't have a lending business, or it's a credit union, or even in some cases, it can be a lender who has users that they're unnecessarily denying loans to, because, you know, monthly debt payments are a common reason. They're the number one reason to deny someone the ability to buy a new home. So there's a wide range of use cases. The underlying borrowing engine that we've built lowers your costs. It scans the borrowing that someone's doing in about 2 minutes of a user flow. And that user flow, you know, at the moment is on our website. We're just stepping out of closed beta now. It could be an embedded widget on a partner's website, or people could hit our API directly. It pulls that user data, leveraging historical credit reports from the credit bureaus, which you will have heard of. It enriches that credit data with some data points that are missing. And then it shops someone against the market. And the market, here's where the incentives bit comes in play. You know, we're looking across any prices anywhere we can find them, sort of like a Plaid. We're doing a combination of scraping as well as direct pricing integrations. And those direct integrations, we just imagine, will continue to grow over time and enrich that credit marketplace. So we're trying to get as many prices and as many products as possible. And then on top of that, there's sort of a thin layer, at the moment, a thin layer, and it'll get thicker over time, of optimization of, okay, so how can we do the best job possible lowering either monthly payments, debt payments of this borrower, or B, the total expected cost of these loans for the borrower. We show both things. We give you visibility on your credit score, the factors that go into that, as well as your debt to income ratio. And yeah, it's that's sort of the borrowing engine that we built. We call it the debt optimizer, and it's across debts, you know, which is an important thing. So another part of the Google search world is things are built up to be single product. But you know, even if you have a mortgage question or you want a mortgage, you should be looking across debts. And it's right back to that being the number one source of denial. It's because of the other non-mortgage debts that someone has that they aren't getting approved for a mortgage. So we take this holistic look across student loans, across personal debt, unsecured loans, credit cards, and mortgages, and figure out the best possible way, given that data that we have, of how to lower your monthly payments or how to improve your DTI, if that's what your question is. And we'll just add to those options over time. You know, so the stuff that we're excited about next is things like adding student loan debt forgiveness, imputing rents into credit scores, adding auto loans. Yeah, but it's short version is a robo for debt across debts. Exciting future is adding more options to for savings. And also the more users we get through this platform, back to that information, informational advantage, the more users we have, you can benefit other users on the platform essentially by using that data on their behalf and negotiating, you know, and getting more user leverage for lower prices and better outcomes.
Love that, Sean. And it's really, really cool what you've built. And I guess I didn't even realize that it spans outside of just different products. I know when we talked about like different use cases, but that's really interesting to think about it holistically, because, you know, I have not done it in a while since building Ostrich, because time has been very limited and, you know, resources have been going to building a startup. But was really, I was first kind of starting out in my career. And one of the challenges that I always had is that there's a number of different ways that I, you know, could qualify for a loan from a an investment perspective, right? So, you know, could be buying a place that I live in for a while, to go the FHA route, which is very different than a primary residence route. But there's also all different types of loans. And I remember it was really challenging for me to figure out like who can offer what types of products. At one point I was looking at bought land that I was going to build on. And it's so difficult to find all of this information and like what types of options are out there. Because there's a number of different ways that, you know, you can. And I'm using the real estate investing example as a specific example, but there's a number of different ways that you could go buy property. It could be a direct mortgage. It could be you have another mortgage, so you do a cash out refinance. There's so many different ways that you could slice it. And it sounds like Solve is becoming that one place that you go to find out what your options are and what you can qualify for.
Yeah, that's exactly the idea. And I didn't know that you were so we're on hand to provide free advice to you anytime, William, for your
home. I need it. I need it.
Finance. Yeah, investment finance needs. So we'll add you to the list. And it's not like innovation in these spaces is making the problem easier for households. Right, like back to that model of A, perfectly informed, B, perfectly rational, borrower or, you know, household. The more options we present, the more difficult it gets. It doesn't get easier, providing, you know, like how many different ways do we have to buy a home now? Like just forget about pure like traditional mortgage options. And is this FHA, Fannie Mae, or a non-QM loan? We now have like non-mortgage and quasi-mortgage ways to buy homes or to finance the down payment. It seems like the more innovation there is on the end product level, the more benefits you can provide by being a layer above that. And in order to be like an efficient layer above all those options, my hypothesis is, you know, you need to be working purely on behalf of the end user, and, you know, people have to trust the calculations their computer's performing and not have questions in the back of their mind about, you know, what, why has their realtor showed them this particular house? Yeah, you need to be clearly a fiduciary in their corner.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I'm fiduciary, just quickly, you know, defining fiduciary for those that maybe aren't familiar with the term. I think that would be helpful, Sean, if you want to take a stab at that real quick.
Yeah, sure. It's someone that doesn't have another customer, you know, making the user your, essentially, you know, your customer, and not having conflicted incentives. You know, when you think of yourself as a fiduciary, I think legally, I remember a law class I took once, you know, you have duties, like the duty of trust, the duty of care, good faith. And it's basically, you know, if you're thinking of decision trees, just that you aren't essentially steering someone down a path where their outcome, you know, in expectation would be worse. And you're, you know, you aren't letting your own incentives as an agent in whatever decision tree they're in, you know, deviate them from what would be the optimal path for their own outcome. Yeah, so it's just placing their outcome first. And an important distinction is that doesn't necessarily mean win-win. You know, so, you know, like when I was working at a lender or as on the investor side, you talk about win-wins. And, you know, like a lot of affiliate marketing can be a win-win. It might be better than a random solution out there. But an online fiduciary, it's not about win-win. It's just about win for the household. What is the best possible win you can get for the household? And then whatever comes to you or to lenders, you know, is next. It, like, it's not a concern at all. You yeah. aren't balancing anything. You're just putting the outcome of the household first.
Yeah, exactly. I love that. I appreciate you kind of taking a step back there, because you hear this too when people talk about financial advisors and making sure that you've got a fiduciary who's actually, you know, as you said, in the has to legally work in the best interest of the client versus a, you know, trader or broker or someone else that, you know, can sell whatever products because they make them a high commission, and they may be in the best interest, but they also may not be. And there's not a legal requirement to actually provide that. So that fiduciary, I think, is really important. And that's what essentially you've been talking about, right? With the incentives and making sure that you're making it, you're giving, providing the best outcomes to households.
Yeah, and there's, yeah. And then like how we legally handle that is a maybe like a different question from, you know, like the ideal version of a fiduciary, you know. So for instance, like in mortgage, a traditional mortgage broker might be acting as a fiduciary by giving you the best price of the prices they have available. And the prices they have available are the lenders that they have pre-established relationships with, so that they're guaranteed payment in that mortgage process, and pre-arranged levels of fees, which can be different amongst, you know, the lenders. So they're giving you the best price out of that set of options. But, you know, like in the ideal world, you know, Sean's ideal world, you have a broker who's not only looking at people that they pre-arranged fees with, but, you know, if they know that there's a cheaper option somewhere else, they're going to send you there. And similarly, you know, to the like long run minded businesses, you have some traditional mortgage brokers who think of the, you know, the value of repeat business and word of mouth. And, you know, so they go a step further towards their ideal. And then you have others which are maybe a bit, you know, more short term and are more like, you know, what are the profits they're going to make this year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, Sean. And I'm curious, as you've been building out Solve Finance, what's been some of the biggest challenges that you've had to face and kind of solve on your journey so far?
Yeah, thanks for asking, because this might be the most useful bit to any other fintech founders listening in. Yeah, like the biggest lesson that I've learned, that, you know, we've learned collectively at the end of a year compared to, you know, before we started out, is really the difference and the sort of the care that you need to give to the finance part of your startup. You know, it was less of an issue at Better. You know, we didn't have that many, you know, like another way of putting it is there's just a difference between building something like a Betterment and an e-commerce website. And most of your, you know, most of the employees you find, most of the engineers you work with or agencies you work with, designers, everyone is going to be more used to this general startup, you know, like applications of technology where it's about setting up a user interface and, you know, showing some products and someone checking out or, you know, buying that product or taking out that loan. And yeah, the big lesson I've learned over our first years, you know, just that you need sort of a separate process or special care to be paid for anything that's like the trading desk part of your operation. So, you know, this is advice that's relevant to people building an advisor or, you know, a robo-advisor of any sort. And just when there's financial math involved, you know, like it's a particular subject matter area that, you know, if developing the algorithm or speccing something out to testing it, even past testing it and staging, if steps along that chain aren't as fully informed about, you know, the financial math or the optimization, you know, or yeah, you know, it's just, you're going to have some attenuation. It's like you're introducing noise. So you sort of need a separate build track. You know, and I've had enjoyable, interesting conversations with people who were at Betterment in the early days, and it turns out, you know, they learned a lot of the lessons that we had to learn ourselves. And so just, yeah, setting up, having that in mind that you're going to need to do some things differently when it touches on financial math and optimizations versus stuff that's more, yeah, just more sort of like standard startup problem solving. You know, when you're talking about a user interface, it's okay to be 80% right. Whereas financial math is either right or wrong. There isn't, you know, 80%. And so That's the difference. That's why you need like a separate track for that.
That makes sense. Yep. No, that makes complete sense. Because obviously you get that wrong and you really messed up for the user. It's not like, to your point, like 80%. Oh, we can forgive that. If it doesn't work, then it fails completely in a sense.
Yeah. There's no right, like there's no, oh, the bun's just a slightly different shade than we imagined. It's either things are right or they're wrong, and if they're, you know, they're wrong, you know, you might not. So it's just hugely important to realize that you're stepping into a sort of different than what you and, you know, your team might be used to playing.
Makes sense. Sean, what does success look like when you think about the future of Solve?
Yeah, I think it's borrowers having really similar outcomes, regardless of who they are and how educated or wealthy they are. It's, you know, instead of seeing a $10,000 difference in prices, you know, like at the closing table for the same interest rate mortgage, we're living in a world where, you know, it's a much, you know, like maybe it's a $1,000 spread. You know, it's things where you aren't unluckily, you know, happening to lose a lot of money by choosing the wrong option. You know, a world where borrowing isn't complicated and painful mentally, and it's not painful in your wallet. Instead, there's this interface, you know, which, you know, we're building it Solve, but, you know, should also get built elsewhere. You know, that there's an interface de-stressing that. And it doesn't need to be Solve branded. You know, it could be, right, it could be Solve at a wealth advisor. It could be at a financial planning app, you know, like Ostrich. I just imagine that there's going to be more than one of these interfaces, but the pain has been taken out of the process. And that's like the immediate pain of, oh, how on earth do I navigate this thing that I haven't done before, or that, you know, I only do once every few years. to also, you know, just not unnecessarily putting, you know, $1,000 a year into lender pockets that you didn't need to be.
I love that. Yeah, I think everyone can get behind that. Yeah, keeping more money in your pocket versus giving it to lenders unnecessarily.
Yeah, I mean, right, it's just like credit scores, you know, FICO, like what on earth have we come up with? You know, it's sort of, yeah, it's like this bizarre tax code that we've given ordinary individuals to wrestle with. And it just seems like we should be abstracting away from that. And there's lots of, you know, like we shouldn't be expecting every person to be able to, you know, be a tax code expert. We just shouldn't expect every single person to be a expert on credit or how mortgages work. There should be instead experts, you know, and part of that automated expertise for them to navigate.
Yeah. No, I love that, right? Yeah, when you think about how all this stuff has popped up, it's never really been to serve the household, right? You know, credit scores, all that stuff was created as a way to help lenders figure out who they can trust, which, you know, somewhat helped, but it was never designed and it's never really been the actual, you know, customer or household.
Yeah. So. Like a great example of FICO, right, is getting your credit score dinged by shopping. You know, why on earth should successfully shopping, price shopping alone, be a negative impact on my credit score? And then not only that, because it's FICO, you know, the credit score ding is handled one way for mortgage shopping versus credit cards. So you have people not shopping mortgages, even when they have like a 15-day grace period of shopping as many loans as they want, because, you know, we've just come up with these bizarre intricacies of how FICO is implemented that are just unnecessary. And yeah, clearly work well for lenders who are looking to maintain margins, but not for households looking to navigate it.
Exactly. Exactly. Sean, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you sharing your experience, what you're building at Solve. And yeah, it's been really great. I want to leave you with final words. So anything that you want to leave the audience with, and then please also let folks know how they can connect with you outside of this podcast.
Thanks. Yeah, I wish I'd asked you some more about Ostrich and done more, but yeah, maybe there'll be a future time. Thanks so much for having me on this podcast. Yeah, in general, if anyone ever wants to talk household finance and solving borrower problems, I'm here, Sean@solve.finance. And as a company, we're here too. And they can go to www.solve.finance. And check us out there. They can try the beta themselves, or, you know, we can think of ways to help your users navigate borrowing better. And whether that's saving money on debts today, whether it's converting more users in your funnel, whether it's growing users in your funnel, if you're a lender, you can join our marketplace and we have free leads for you. So a lot of way for us to work with, almost any fintech out there. And they can reach us at our website, solve.finance.
Awesome. Fantastic. Thanks again for sitting down, Sean.
Thank you.
On your way out, please share the podcast with others. It's the only way that the community grows and others hear these incredible stories from entrepreneurs and top performers. And of course, pound that subscribe button so you get notified when episodes drop every Friday. I'm William Glass, CEO and co-founder of Ostrich, and of course, your host of the Silicon Alley Podcast. Have a very profitable day. You got no time to waste, but still you hesitate. Caught in a circle saying, I'll never leave this place. Ooh. Some words got you searching for the bright side over and over until you're looking.